Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard.
Oh, there's a thing that will get edited out of the episode. Who wants to lead us into our doom?
I think you should, frankly.
This is perfect. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Enter Number Here of Horror Vanguard. I am one of your hosts, Ashley Darrow, and I am maybe a vampire, maybe just Catholic, maybe also just from Pennsylvania. No one really knows anymore. I am joined, as always, by Kyle Kern, at Labor Kyle, and at the Lit Crit Guy. How's it going, everyone?
I'm trying to dial this phone to get a hold of the hospital and the police, but I'm not entirely sure how phones work. Can someone help me, please?
I am also maybe Catholic and maybe a vampire, but maybe those are the same thing. Who knows?
Well, we've got an exciting episode today with special guest and telephone expert Alexander Graham Bell, who is definitely a vampire. How's it going?
Ahoy, ahoy, or whatever the...
Whatever the first thing is.
I don't remember.
That's, you know, we're talking about Martin today, George Romero's favorite of his creations.
Ash, what's that? What's that about?
It's the only problem with me doing the episode introduction is I have to at some point say, Ash, what's today's movie about?
Yeah, we just volley.
In the wake of the cultural cavitation that was the late 80s to early 90s authenticity crisis, an array of marketable auras were stamped out of the same ready-made molds that generated the cavitation in the first place. This false consciousness of snaked and winding sincerities devoured and subsumed earnest proletarian expressions less like a Walmart parking lot paving over a native prairie, and more akin to the ubiquity of a well-maintained lawn being sold back to the working class as a sign of safety and personal stability. Even accidental exposure to the social machinery was enough to carve trajectories inward. From a McDonald's in Texas to a niche shirt on Kurt Cobain's back, Daniel Johnston's music became one of the high watermarks for this blooming new sincerity. Johnston's music has been described as innocent to the point of being childlike, deeply haunting, and unbearably raw. While all of this is true, it is often overlooked how both Johnston's precursor lo-fi sound and the immediacy of his lyrics fit bitterly into capitalism's mold of a new hit indie sensation. These lo-fi beats to struggle against manic depression while capitalism turns your soul into a site of extraction too, aren't unique to a given artist or cultural moment, but are endemic to how capital approaches art. Vampiric sincerity, or how capital has transformed, at a much earlier stage than this, the forms of sincerity into new sites of extraction. The focal points of the real can be wholly dislodged from their aura as the very concept of authenticity itself is mediated through oppressive modes of commerce. Were any of these deep moments authentic, or was there a certain meta-authenticity that laundered our emotional response and, perhaps even more starkly, what becomes of our contact with the Zizekian framing of the real when our core emotional framework is just a is just as synthesized by capital as our ideology? A return to Johnston's lyrics from his song Devil Town. And all my friends were vampires. Didn't know they were vampires. Turns out I was a vampire myself in the Devil Town. Whether we struggle to find ways out of our castles or castigate each other for our participation in the blood-sucking, we're still just vampires. Join us as we discuss Martin.
Yeah!
Listeners, as I read that out loud, I think that is the second time in a Precy I've used Daniel Johnston's song to link to Mark Fisher's Exiting the Vampire Castle, but I don't remember which episode that was. So there's for the real heads out there who know this show better than the people who create it.
Yeah, if the Horror Vanguard archivist could let us know.
Yeah, the withered skeleton we keep chained to the back of the HV crypt who must memorize all of the things we say to bear the weight of insanity. Please let us know what's going on. So, I can't think of a better place to discuss today's episode than by discussing the Groovy Ghoulies, a band that famously covered Daniel Johnston's song Deviltown.
Oh, yeah, is that right?
There's something for anyone who's ever listened to the Groovy Ghoulies. I raise my glass to you.
Sacramento, I think, pop punk band.
Sacramento, baby! Also, I'm Into Life Records released a Halloween covers compilation that features probably my favorite Daniel Johnston cover. It's a cover of his Casper the Friendly Ghost song, and it is soul-crushing. So go check that out, listeners. There's some music recommendations at the top of today's episode. So go watch George Romero's Martin. Go learn who the Groovy Ghoulies are. And then go buy that song from I'm Into Life Records. And then come back, and you'll be well-informed for today's discussion.
Yeah, we've gone as far into the niche crevasse as we can already. Almost including...
I'm just flexing my aura and my authenticity by being niche and unrelatable.
Isn't that what Horror Vanguard is all about? at the end of the day.
Yeah. Ash, you've been doing that for like 300 episodes.
That's true.
And it's just built one of the best... It's just built one of the best podcasts about movies ever, so...
Oh, we have fun. And we're about to have even more fun when we enter the formalism zones. Zone, zone, zone.
The formalism zone.
Zone, 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 zone.
And why not start us off, John, with singing us the ballad of black and white cinema?
What is cinema about, if not the presentation of time and memory? Super cool. Super cool black and white flashbacks in this. The still yet to be released to nearly 3-hour cut of this film that exists somewhere. It will have so many more completely incomprehensible black and white shots in it. And I can't wait. I can't wait for it to be out in the world. Yeah, what do you both think? What do you both think about the flashback sequences and the black and white?
So I think my favorite thing about the flashback sequences in this are how they really like Martin is so mediated in terms of how he sees himself and how the world sees him. And like there's almost like this is so interesting for when this movie came out and what this movie's discussing and the figure of the vampire in media broadly, but he almost has no authentic core. And we get these black and white flashbacks of his, and they're all the kind of like, these are very expressionist cinema visions of vampiric sexiness. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like young, powerful vampires, frail women, gothic castles. It's very classic. And then it contrasts to like this like grimy guy in Pennsylvania just skittering around trains and like in weird, creepy situations. So I think there's a lot to be said there about how we interact with our own desire and how that desire is mediated through the technology of the moving image.
Yeah, this is first and foremost weird little guy cinema. it's just like, what if a weird little guy went around drugging and biting people? What I really liked about that sort of textural choice is what it reminds me of. Memory is a really useful lens for it. It reminds me in some ways of the French filmmaker Chris Marker, one of my personal favorites, a genius of the documentary style, whose two primary subjects were the political and labor conflicts in the 1960s and 70s and so on, as well as memory. Those are his two sort of like primary subjects of engagement throughout the entirety of his career from the very beginning to when he died just several years ago. This idea that this very like that that's always felt very gothic to me, using the fundamentals of our perception of the world as a disruptive mechanism to that same function. Like, we are constantly like seeking this bottleneck of meaning that is often interpreted through our own memory. And personal memory and historical memory being sort of distinct ideas, but that ultimately intersect in the perception of individual people and their lives as they relate to the functions of the social world. And when you kind of breathe life into that social function, the social function aspect, instead of the, you know what it reminds me of? I talked about this in a YouTube video. I made an essay that was mostly a reflection on the opioid crisis in Florida, which has really intensely affected my family, as it has a lot of families where I'm from. And the memory is not frightening enough in the way that people describe it. People describe it through the lens of nostalgia most of the time, and as something I've also gone on the internet and been very critical of. And rather, there's this, I referred to memory as a fish trap, right? It's something that you can swim down, but you can't swim back up. And those sort of like reflective functions are something that, I believe it's very uncanny, this idea of absence and loss. And now this isn't a film about, you know, absence and loss necessarily, but it's about trying to interpret the sort of differences in interpretation of subjective experience. Is something magic? Is something not? Is someone a vampire? Are they not? What exactly does it mean to be vampiric? And as the viewers, where those ideas, their concrete place in culture, are constantly brought into question, not just in the script and in the story and in the relationship between the two central characters, who are cousins and come from entirely different generations and from different different geographies. They share some like identities as, like, you know, present in the American Midwest and around the same time through their sort of kinship relations. But there's this the conflict at the center of the movie is really about this interpretation of the social world. And I mean, that's Romero's, that's a big part of his whole thing. How our reaction to these frightening and uncanny aspects of the world around us shape us as individual people. So I thought I thought its use was, I thought it was really well done in the way that you are these kind of like very ordinary and mundane, often riding on a train, walking into a house, walking down the street during a parade, are often intercut with either audio or visual disruptions. And that, yeah, I think that's how I feel about it.
That was like a pricey in and of itself. That is a phenomenal take, and I think a very important one too. And those like audio disruptions, I think, are another important thing to key in on here. And this, I think, can lead us into our last formalism point with the score. The score in this film, like, I found it to be like so wonderfully disruptive. It's this kind of like almost wacky, like spooky, slightly gothic synth score that fits into this movie so jarringly. But I think that it worked for me for the overall tone by creating like yet another point of uncomfortable dissonance. Like, this is a deeply uncomfortable film. What are some y'all's thoughts on today's tunes?
I'm composer Donald Rubinstein. Tales from the Dark Side.
Yes.
The television series Monsters, as well as what else? Nothing else that I know. Yeah, my take is basically how I just described it. There's this, like, it's not clean. This isn't for being such a sort of like a quiet and in some ways a very plodding movie. It's what I like about it is that it's not clean. It's very reflective. We'll talk about Braddock later, but it mm-hmm. has this like there's this sort of like clean transitions of historical change that we have in retrospect. We can look back and see, you know, why a city is different than the way that it used to be. But when you're experiencing it, it's very jarring, and it's very difficult. So yeah, I think the music did a great deal of heavy lifting for just that. The atmosphere in general was something that I think was being emphasized quite a bit, which is probably what confused some of the people who were watching it. But is very fitting for the sort of the essence of the Romero filmography.
I could not agree more. And I think a fitting and related music question, and you know, like this is a question that I might have saved for like the next HV Q&A episode, which now we have to do one now that we have a third host, Kyle, now that you're part of the show. I feel a Q&A is in order. So listeners, send us your questions by howling them into the darkest corner of your mind where we live. But related to our conversations of authenticity and media and spooky stuff, do you have any thoughts on Taylor Swift's Florida?
I do. I definitely do. So what Ashley is referencing is on the newest Taylor Swift record, speaking of plotting, a 30 track, like,
ooh.
It's okay. So like
studio meddling. No,
I ranted about this on, I believe on Bubba Hotep a little bit, but, one of the most fundamental aspects of new, especially pop, media is getting as many streaming numbers as you can. And so you put out a record that has 25 to 30 songs on it, and then you put out a deluxe version of that same record, and you hope as many people as possible click over and listen to both different versions of it. In this case, it definitely worked. Tortured Poets Department, a very decidedly not good. I think if you want my opinion on the entire record, just read the Paste magazine review that where they had to make the author anonymous for fear of retribution, because the last time they gave a not so great review of a Taylor Swift record, they doxed the writer. This is it, which is just like, that's its own thing. That's its own thing. We talked about it on Bubba Hotep. People will, but there is a song on this record called Florida with 3 exclamation points. That was co-written with Florence Welch from Florence and the Machine, and also features Florence in, she has a verse and a chorus, and then they sort of trade off lines, toward the end of the song. Taylor Swift's Florida is, I hate it. And the reason why I hate it, we talked about, funny enough, it's one of the less like boring songs on the record. It at least has like, it has this kind of like pulsing chorus that I find interesting. I think Jack Antonoff's production is, sleepy time tea. For music.
Yes.
So I agree with a lot of the people who are saying Taylor needs to have a trial separation from Jack Antonoff's production. I agree. But maybe also, I can't remember which Desner brother she works with. Is it Bryce? One of the guitar, there's the twin guitar players and songwriters from The National. Aaron Desner, I think it is actually. Taylor Swift has been writing songs with him for a while. I think at least since the Evermore record, which I have not really heard. I have heard that one. That one was okay. I don't think he co-wrote. At least he doesn't have a co-writing credit on this one. The only co-writing credit I think I saw was Florence. But it's a song that, it's apparently going to put Destin on the map, which, like, if you don't know what Destin, Florida is, it's a smaller town in the panhandle, like most of the towns in the panhandle, that people pay attention to. It's the one with a beautiful beach on it. It's a place. It's a song about how Florida is a place where you go to forget about your problems, which is remarkable. No one has ever thought of that before. There's not an entire body of music that's specifically about how you go to Florida to forget about your problems. But I think my main problem with Florida isn't just because it's not a very interesting song, and not just because it has something that we talked about on the Crawl episode. This, like, there's an artful way to encounter Florida as a place, even in from a very cynical perspective. I used Harmony Korine as an example of a way to do this actually effectively, like to take the kind of like to turn the kind of voyeuristic lens of Florida back on itself and allow it to kind of like reflect our own perception of this place that is very like captured in popular consciousness in an almost entirely negative light. It's something that you go to extract from. People don't live there. It's people only go there. And in this case, it is a place where Taylor Swift goes to forget about her breakup. Shocker. I had seen this before. Supposedly she broke up with one of her boyfriends. I don't know which one. I don't know who any of them are unless they're professional football players. Not to be so bro-y about it, but like, I don't really know any of the people that she's in relationships with, but apparently she was in a 6-year relationship with some person and that they broke up, right before she played her Tampa shows at the Eras Tour. She played 3 nights in Tampa. And apparently the reception to those shows was very, very good because she was really feeling it or whatever. And so everyone who buys her tickets to her shows and gives her all of this money can also be her emotional support consumer by letting her know how much we love her and all of that sort of a thing. Like, look, I'm not a Taylor Swift hater, because that would require me to enter into this absolutely bizarre, like parasociality that has taken over mainstream pop music. Well, everyone is my best friend. Like, there's no more pop artist by committee. The committee has been buried underneath the guise of my very close personal friend, Taylor Swift. And like the lyrics of the song are it's just like Florence Welch is burying her ex in a swamp. And it's just like, yeah, this is where you come to dump your dead bodies. This is where you come to, like, I'm in Florida right now, so that's why I'm speaking a little more from this perspective. But, this is a place where you come to, like, it's the service economy of states. It's a playground. It's been a playground for the rich for a very long time because there's no state income tax. Plain and simple. That's why. And it's a popular vacation spot because there's good beaches that are at this point a majority privately owned. Speaking of another HV episode, we talked about it on Color Me Blood Red. The Florida commentary on Horror Vanguard is remarkable. Mm-hmm. No one has this. Like, sincerely, no one has this in their podcast. So, I'm very grateful to have had, I think I said this in the Crawl episode, I'm grateful to have had the chance to sort of talk about Florida in a more extensive way. But I was talking about that essay that I wrote about my family, which is really like, that's much closer to the experience of actual Floridians rather than the like extractive, voyeuristic, the experiences of the mode of production, the experiences of capitalism's assertions rather than the experiences of those who are subjected to the assertions of capitalism. Florida is not a place to come forget about your exes. Florida is a place where people die too young because of the opioid crisis. And this is true of all kinds of places, mm-hmm. but it takes a particular character in Florida because of tourism, and because of its idea of this, like, it's a place that disappears when you don't perceive it. So it's weird to not be one of the, like, there's the forgotten parts of America, right? A lot of places in the Midwest, that are just like Braddock, for example. Now I'm making a controversial statement talking about, Western Pennsylvania as the Midwest, but it is, like, both historically and actually, it is the Midwest.
Absolutely.
And then there's the places that are in the, like, you know, Florida being the third largest state by population in the entire country. It is constantly in the news because of certain kinds of law, a certain law called Florida in the Sunshine. That means we have really, really open public records. So that's where all of the Florida Man stories come from. Everyone is always talking about it, but not perceiving it. And to talk about Florida without perceiving it is the Taylor Swift song. To talk about Florida while perceiving it is to experience what it was like and has always been like to live here, which is not easy. I think that's my take on Taylor Swift's Florida. The record's not good and the song is also not good. And she can't, you can't have that, Taylor. Also from Pennsylvania, fun fact.
So it all comes together. Yeah. It all comes together.
Look at
together.
That. We did it.
We come full circle. And listeners, if you want Florida, open parentheses, Kyle's version, you can head over to patreon.com/horrorvanguard, where that's a thing that will happen, assuming an infinitely long timeline. We'll eventually do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just got to wait for us to like get more musical on the show. Just wait, it's coming. Mm. But I think that is such good analysis, and so many of those points that you made too, like are I think like applicable back on to our like study of Braddock in Pennsylvania more broadly, and in kind of like the larger like socioeconomic conditions in which this is represented. You know, like how it's not just like that like Florida and Pennsylvania kind of magically radiate. You know, Florida's not generating Florida mans because Florida has some kind of like madness wavelength that washes up on the shore every day and drives people to this. It's generating that for very specific sets of material and social conditions. Yeah. And I think we can make the same analysis as we kind of turn our attention over to B.F. Skinner. Dun, dun, dun. There's a twist.
Yeah, I put that in our document because I don't know if we saw the very subtle at the beginning of the movie as he's leaving the first train car that he's in. There's a copy of B.F. Skinner's Beyond Freedom and Dignity on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I found that very telling and interesting. I feel like I've talked enough already for the entire episode, but. I don't know if anyone else noticed that.
Oh, listeners, we can only afford so much horror Kyle over here at Horror Vanguard, and we have just hit our daily quotient.
This is why people are always complaining on the HV Discord, which you get access through patreon.com/horrorvanguard. People are always complaining on the Discord. They're like, we want more Kyle. Where's Kyle? Are you going to bring Kyle into this episode? Why isn't there more Kyle in this episode? It happens all the time.
You know, I'm in the Discord.
Do you know how much it costs Kyle for a feature? Do you know how much it costs Kyle for a hook? Let alone a beat? Let alone a melody? Like, listeners, we need support to get more Kyle.
$50,000 for a verse, no album out.
John, do you have any Skinner thoughts before we I don't know, vampire as a verb our way on over to the next point?
I mean, what is the movie about, really? I think setting it in Braddock and the reference to Skinner and the reference to strikes and all of the shots of trains.
Yes.
This is a movie about alienation, like because really, what is the vampire? The vampire is the human dislocated from humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole point is Romero is honestly really direct, and it's so strange that like people tie themselves in knots trying to kind of like decode the metaphor when in almost all of his work the metaphor is like so burningly straightforward. Mm-hmm. Like he's a very socially aware filmmaker, but he's not like a complex filmmaker. It's like, so the whole point of the vampire for Romero is this idea of like explicating a certain aspect of human nature from itself, right? Can you mythologize it in order to kind of like cast it out? It becomes the Girardian scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
All of the mimetic desire within us becomes like concretized in the externality of the vampire. And Romero just goes, well, that just doesn't work, right? What is it that Martin keeps saying over and over again? There is no magic. There's no magic, right? There isn't some like all of this vampiric desire doesn't exist as an externality, but is something that is kind of corralled and organized and disciplined through the mechanisms of capitalist of the social fabric of capitalist society, right? It's so telling that this happens in Braddock. It's not just because they had no money, right? Like it's an aesthetic choice that reveals the philosophical commitments of the film itself, right? Vampirism is alienation. Not only like socially, economically, but crucially existentially.
I think you hit the nail on the head with so much of that, and I think in a really important way. This is almost like a demythologizing of the vampire, and by taking it
it's
gothic context and it's horror context, and putting it instead in a context where we don't like. I kept thinking about I kept kind of contrasting this with El Conde in my like last viewing of Martin a few days ago, and like how El Conde is, at least, you know, listeners, go back to that one by going to patreon.com/bonus-episodes/horror-vanguard/Kyle Affordance Fund. And like, you know, like how that one is like, it's still very gothic, it's still very vampiric, it's still very mythical, and how for me that was like a major hang up that I kind of couldn't get past while watching it. But in this one, like, this is almost like the vampire by way of like Nymphomaniac or Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, right? This is just like a very gritty, down-to-earth, gross vampire movie that's not quite as sexy, right, as literally every other vampire movie. So in that respect, it's really refreshing. But like by taking it out of that context, it does do exactly what you're suggesting here, which is like force us to look at every other context around this and to reconsider the vampire.
Yeah, do you think the vampire is something out there, right? Do you think it's some sort of myth? And it's like the entire film is like, no, it's just like it's you, right? Isn't that the worst thing? Isn't that like the most horrifying thing? You know, you have it's the 70s. It's like it's like labor action and strikes and what is it they all talk about around the dinner table? There are no decent jobs anymore. And there's the breakdown and slow unspooling of a social fabric. And it's like, what are you gonna do? You can't. And I actually think the link to Catholicism is super interesting, because it's like this has gotten the most boring exorcism scene in any film I've ever watched. Because it really isn't about like the theology. It's about the re legato. It's about the binding back of like what does the institution of Catholicism function as in this film? It isn't like the spiritual authority, right? No, it's just like it's the community center, right? It's the last kind of like fraying edge of some sort of like social unity that exists in this place. This is a movie about like alienation in the 70s.
It made me think immediately of a book that I've plugged on probably too many podcasts at this point. It's called The Next Shift. It's by tangentially a Twitter friend of the show, Gabriel Winant. Gabe is a historian at the University of Chicago. He's one of the good labor historians working these days that I refer to him as. The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare for Rust Belt America, I think is the whole title. And it's a book that's specifically about Pittsburgh. Gabe is a kind of structuralist, not to speak for him, but he has this kind of like structural view on labor history that doesn't neglect the, as you're saying, John, the sort of the existential problems. He does that through the oral history testimony, as well as through a lot of really good and rigorous primary source research, where The Next Shift is about places like Braddock, who were at the center of the steel industry in the United States. Pittsburgh was always about steel for so long. And then as manufacturing started to leave the United States, different either different industries came in to replace it, or cities were just kind of sort of left to rubble, and all of the people inside of them, mostly the descendants of European immigrants from the 1920s mm-hmm. and 30s, and then eventually just almost exclusively Black people. And so Gabe's book basically examines the shift from the steel industry and into healthcare as the primary industry. Basically, Pitt Health is now the primary employer for all of Pittsburgh. And there's something really fundamental to that shift. It's not just descriptive in how, like, you know, industry leaves and something new comes to replace it. And it, that, like, how these aren't just sort of like, there is no magic in this. It's as the result of very particular processes, because when steel workers got old, they needed more healthcare. And so as the economy changed, it gave rise to a new economy of care. And so hospitals, and so why was the place where everyone was a steel worker now where everyone is a nursing assistant? And it places that in conversation with, mm-hmm. not just the sort of like the changes in production that results in the healthcare industry, but like how the members of the healthcare industry are in like labor conflict, and how those like the like labor conflict at like hospitals and places of healthcare as sites of some of the most like evil and pernicious aspects of contemporary capitalism, but also the conflict that has risen. So there's some really incredibly powerful conflicts. I have friends who are organized with like SEIU 1199, which is their healthcare division. Always forever shout outs to them, as well as the healthcare workers I know personally who listen to this podcast. You're awesome and I love you. Several of you whom I have recommended this book to specifically. So they have already heard all of this. A couple of people, when we've had personal conversations before I was even a full-time member of this show. There is something really remarkable about the way that this movie describes that. And just as you're both saying, it's not like couched in like layer after layer of impenetrable metaphor. It's right there for you. The movie is telling you what it's about. I think it's a book that is not just like timely in for our contemporary moment, but that has a full understanding of the pain in shifts in production that this movie does the same, like in our attempts to sort of find our place as individual people. Because you can imagine yourself as a steel worker in Pittsburgh, whether from your union, if you're unionized, whether from your union or from your employer, like the industry relied on your identification with it. And so the disruption of that, like mining is very similar, sort of like a very similar occurrence. Another one of my favorite filmmakers, who I am currently trying to write my best about in my book, is Emil D'Antonio, who is from Scranton, Pennsylvania, so the other side of the state, but a place that was really associated with mining. And I believe he's descended from Italian immigrant miners. And he was another filmmaker who used the documentary style to illustrate the changes and the political conflicts that occurred through the 60s and the 70s, less from a labor perspective, but more about he made In the Year of the Pig, the most brutal anti-war documentary I think that's still ever been made, which we should talk about on this show sometime, as well as like just this very inventive like imaginations of time and place, not as these static sort of like these static pictures through which we can like look back and gain inspiration, but as these active changing and moving things that directly affect the lives of people who are in them. And if you've ever done any kind of labor organizing across any kind of industry, you understand the walking the line and trying to find the balance between people's identification with their particular kind of work and the way that that work in those environments end up treating them and their families. And so it's this really powerful kind of message of, you know, trying to interpret the process of interpretation for all of that is something that I think people are still trying to figure out. And that's where I think labor history is actually really useful for the, and is always in conversation with these, with this type of horror that's very fixed in a particular time and place.
Mm-hmm. I think oh, go on, please, John, please.
The only thing I was going to add to that in the context of like labor relations and alienated labor and the kind of toll of alienation on the kind of social fabric of a given location is like, oh, who is arguably the most important character in the film? The most important character in the film, quite arguably, is just a voice, right? It's the talk radio host.
Yes.
Right? There's this media operation that kind of like sublimates and represses and works through all of these, all of like Martin's often very inchoate and inarticulate desires. But that has its own political utility, right? It's so kind of like key to me that like in the context of everything that Kyle has said, that like talk radio is the big thing. Like the very first time you hear the radio, it's kind of like mixed as background audio for a conversation. But if you pay attention, they're talking about like strike action that's happening. And that's already like just like the bubbling subtext of the life world of the film.
So I think this reloading my brain. Sorry, I just got the word that I can move in tomorrow. So I think the AM radio thing is like really, 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 really good analysis on this. It's so many levels because it ties into what you're both saying about labor and alienation. Because we're living kind of through a moment right now where if you're doing anything that is under the very broad category of intellectual labor, your job is being hunted by Silicon Valley right now. Like AI's lowest hanging fruit is stuff like the AM radio disc jockey. It's writers, it's artists. We're seeing automated art displacing people in the film industry as well. Like this is really stuff like we're going to talk about Dune. The Dune episode looms heavy over Horror Vanguard. Like a carry-all carrying some spice extraction equipment into a Fremen trap. And the Fremen trap is discourse. I don't remember how I got on the Dune analogy. But anyway, I'm just gonna start talking about how I don't think the movie actually treated Princess Irulan's character very well, let alone Chaney. But I digress yet again. And so we get to like the AM radio stuff. And I think what's also going on there too is like so much of our identity is mediated through the media that we regularly consume, right? And like, you know, like obviously, like because of how we have set up our understanding of like culture, or like quote unquote superstructural elements. You know, it's so easy to be like, oh, there's a goth kid. They must listen to a lot of goth music, which informs their tastes and sensibilities. But in the same way that you can go, I can tell you shop at Hot Topic, you can also go, I can tell you listen to AM radio, right? Like the effect that our media has on us in relation to our status as workers under capital, like should never, ever be discredited or ignored.
So I kind of have a theory, right? And I'm curious to see what the two of you think, which is that. So, like, the obvious question is, like, is Martin a vampire? And really, I think the answer of the film is no.
Yeah.
Right? But it is someone who's enacting a kind of metaphoric. There's this metaphoric and symbolic register to blood, right? When it comes to vampirism, what is blood drinking? It's not even metaphor; it's cinematic euphemism, right? The blood drinking is the euphemism for sex, right? And if you understand, if you read the film that way, this is like a young 20 something year old who's constantly talking about his inability to have sex. And is basically murdered for his pansexuality by a religious family member. So it's not, is it really about vampirism? And this connects to exactly what you're talking about in the mediation of identity,
mm-hmm.
right? Through kind of like these institutions of media. Because like on the late night radio show, what do we want to hear about? We want to hear from the Count. And all of these stories of mm-hmm, following mm-hmm. people desiring blood, all of these things of like sexually voyeuristic behavior that we want to like you know, get some kind of like titillation out of. But what do you think about that? Am I kind of going nowhere with this?
You are fucking nailing it. You are doing so good. Clap, clap, clap. I say like I'm not the person on the show who's like, yeah, anyway, this reminds me of like a plant I had in 2008. But unlike the plants I had in 2008, which all died horrible deaths due to my negligence, the following take will thrive. I think the kind of like psychosexual element of this is so fucking strong, right? Because like one, like we have the queering of Martin, right? And like perceptions of queer people under the kind of like libidinal economy of capitalism, right? And like there's this temptation to like sexually pathologize everything in our society. But I think it's really important to flag up that temptation is like very reactionary at its core. Right. And it's not like a sexual pathology, but it's the libidinal economy. It's something deeper. It's like something more that's going on here. Right. And like, you know, capitalism is reducing no matter what. It doesn't matter if Martin's a vampire or not. It doesn't matter. Like, because Martin's talking like there's a section that I really love where Martin's like he's doing the like Return to the Living Dead thing with like, you're like, you mean the movies lied? And he's like, oh, vampire. It's not like the movies. Come on, guys. Vampires are totally different. But no one cares, right? Because people want to just talk about his like weird edging, yeah, exactly, psychosexual practices. Like he's making money for the radio station, and like it doesn't matter. Like that's the parallel with Daniel Johnston I felt here, because it doesn't matter if Martin is like, oh, I'm doing the Lestat thing, and I'm finally getting to share my story as a vampire, or if he's just like dealing with a lot of stuff, as I'm sure a vampire killer would be, you know. And this isn't to paint Martin in a positive light here. Like, he is a rapist and a murderer and like not a good guy, TM. But like, you know, it kind of doesn't matter what his motivations are. Like, he can be extracted, right? Like, value can be squeezed from him no matter what he is and what he's doing. And I think like that's the thing that like Romero is so good at with his movies, is kind of expressing that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so someone else take the ball.
Well, on the radio show, he talks about, especially toward the end, his broadcast into the radio program at the end was extremely telling. He talks about how like it's not like you see vampires, they get all the girls. That's not actually how it is, because the quote is, in real life, you can't get people to do what you want them to do. And that feeling of powerlessness, and sexual impotence, is definitely the sort of the question of sexual performance is the same as the question of the existence of vampirism itself. Can we, having not seen it and only heard about it, and only from this sort of like negative framing, or this a negative projection, really, there's a lot of projection happening about him, around him, while he also struggles to maintain some sense of control over his desires. It is like we brought up desire earlier, and I think that's really important, because desire for him is this, it's the most incredibly intimate yet fundamentally foreign aspect of his subjective identity. Our desire is a moving object that's never actually fixed in one place. It exists on we see it from a particular horizon that it gives the appearance of moving, of staying fixed in one place, but it's actually moving fundamentally further and further away. Just as you feel like you've gotten a grip on it, all of a sudden it flits away and moves off into some other sort of aspect of subjective identity.
Desire is the thing which is created in the act of moving towards it.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right. Which is why it's so important that this is a film about alienation, right? Because these things are not contradictory. These things are not like kind of creating any sort of friction. Like the relationship, the kind of like relationships and dynamics of desire that are in play on the subjective level are entirely kind of like conditioned and respondent to and dependent upon the conditions of the economic and social totality on the macro level, right? There is one economy, right? The shots of the, like, there is no contradiction between like all the shots of like trains and like former rundown estates in Braddock on the one hand, and like him breaking into the house of the woman that he's become obsessed with, finding that she has a lover, which is a super interesting moment, and then like drugging and feeding on him rather than her, right? This is all of a piece. This is all of like, this is like, these two things are kind of like symbiotic together, right?
Absopositutely.
I forgot the point that I was going to make, but I remembered that I just want to let everyone know that I am an ally to the pansexual community, as I am constantly, I am surrounded by pansexual podcasters all the time. And I love them all dearly and will defend them with all of my Kinsey Six gay might. I see you.
We appreciate your service.
This is what allyship is all about, podcasting.
Kyle receives today's allyship point.
Yay! I get to be an ally.
You can redeem this at the pansexual store, Kyle.
Patreon.com/horrorvanguard.
Where for just 2 allyship points a month, for less allyship points than the price of a cup of coffee. Listeners, today we are rounding towards the end of today's episode, and my, have we talked about a lot of things, most of them related to today's movie film. Do we have any parting takes, oh fellow co-ghosts?
I think that's about it, right?
And that silence means, listeners, that today's takes have dried up. The take round is over.
Before we close off the take factory, before we all punch out, one thing that I really found kind of remarkable, just comment on a scene that I really like that I think kind of describes the film, is at the very end when Martin is finds himself kind of like walking in a parade, and he's surrounded by the environmental storytelling kind of comes to a head right before the final climactic scene in the movie. I thought that was really artful, particularly as with the very end of the film, when the final thing we hear before the credits is Ode to Joy, played on, I'm assuming, some kind of church bells. I thought that was very good. We don't have to get into the whole, you know, the whole Zizekian Ode to Joy thing, which I think is very, actually still holds up pretty well as this kind of, speaking of desire and the political and all of that stuff, it's this Ode to Joy is this kind of like transcendent vision into the beyond the symbolic registers that we all rely on in order to kind of make sense of our world. Put Ode to Joy in your movie and you can get me to talk at length about it, probably, if I had to guess.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us to today's Ode to Podcasting. We look forward to seeing you next week when we discuss enter movie title that I don't know if we can at this point discuss that we're reviewing. So I look forward to that forthcoming conversation.
Yeah, there's big stuff happening.
Stay forthcoming. Stay not disclosed, audience.
We hope you've enjoyed the Dread Discourse. Until next week, stay spooky.